This is my name for exhortations. The Sivandharas, the bhikkhus, the full moon of January, the first full moon in 1989. It's probably somebody's birthday, I think Placido Domingo. And so this time also, it's important that we reaffirm our commitment to this retreat, to the silence, to reaffirm our determination, adhitana, to be resolute in our practice. This having the opportunity to practice and the Dhamma, it's really a rare and wonderful thing to be able to contemplate and say that just the way things are, including from the most ordinary conditions to the real reflection in insight into ultimate reality, or emptiness, the conditioned and the unconditioned. This is really taking the human experience to its fullest. You can't really do anything more than that. That is the complete and total understanding, is to see that perfect relationship of the conditioned with the unconditioned. Oftentimes this is represented as the marriage between the male and the female. Sometimes the female is represented as the unconditioned, the formless. The male is the conditioned, the form. And this, or whatever quality you give to it in our symbols, it's the positive negative and the totality and that which manifests and disappears. What arises ceases. And so in that perfect marriage or that in that perfect relationship, then that is beyond just the making preferences, isn't it? We're not seeking just the unconditioned and rejecting the condition, but we're going back to the ultimate perfection of that oneness, where they're in perfect harmony rather than divided, separated. Materialism, of course, is only pays attention to the conditioned realm, isn't it? It's modern materialism and modern attitudes are very much about trying to make the conditions perfect, isn't it? Trying to make everything perfect on the conditioned plane. And here in Western Europe, of course, there's been since the Second World War, a kind of fantastic attempt to produce with our modern science and technology the best that you can possibly think of and manifest it into material form, what we need for comfort and beauty and pleasure. In this productions from the human mind have been created, manifested into the world. We get this overwhelming materialism, which is never satisfying. It's never satisfying. It's, no matter how efficient beautiful, comfortable, we might be able to create a material world around us. It's something totally unsatisfactory about it. In fact, you find some of the most discontented people in these countries like this one, or kind of affluent countries, where they have everything, but contentment. I was reading about all these immigrants trying to get into these Western European countries from the Third World, especially they're dying to go into Denmark and Sweden and the Scandinavian countries, where they have these super duper social welfare systems, where you just have things laid on for you from birth to the grave, and then every absolute security from just being born in Denmark means that you're going to be taken care of till you die. And it's totally laid on by an affluent, wealthy society. That sounds really wonderful, doesn't it? Especially, I suppose, if you come from a third world country where you don't have that security, where you have to kind of scrounge around to try to survive. And nothing's laid on for you. The time you were born, you more or less struggle to keep going. And yet, countries like that have high suicide rates and alcoholism, and other kind of horrible problems that human society, humans tend to create out of the conditioned realm as an end in itself can only be suffering. It's only dukkha as an end in itself, which doesn't mean a put-down of the conditioned realm. It needs to be related to the unconditioned, doesn't it? It needs its partner. It needs its perfection, and in itself, it has not. It can't be perfect. Because it's only a part. It arises and ceases. This is why the Buddha pointed to the way to end of suffering through the realization of these Four Noble Truths, which is the way that one can actually know this through practice, through contemplation, through our ability to reflect using our reflective capacities to their fullest. This is what we're doing on this retreat, I hope. What I'm doing anyway. What you're doing, only you know. A conditioned realm, we can create conditions with our minds, just like you create signs to meditate on. You can create images in your mind, you can create lights. Once you begin to realize the power of creation that we have, so many of you are conditioned by a society that has not developed or even really understands that power. We're very much conditioned by life, aren't we? We're put into schools at a young age, and then we are conditioned by the value systems and the whole educational programming of our respective societies, which tend to make us sometimes quite, not really fully appreciate the real wonders of our existence and capacities as individual beings. I remember when I was a young university student feeling quite depressed and a sense of despair over the values that had been kind of instilled in my mind up to that time about that you were kind of, it was, everyone was trying to be very analytical about themselves in those days, and one always came out with the feeling that you were kind of permanently somehow not quite right person. There was this sense of normality that you believed somehow existed somewhere, and that you didn't quite fit into it. And somehow you somehow missed the mark. And there was this vague sense of what was considered normal by the society in America of the 50s. And then you felt, well, I personally felt that I somehow missed out on that. I didn't feel that I fit into that, into what was considered normal. But I thought everybody else did. Except a few oddballs or something. But I thought that I was probably the only, you know, one of those abnormal beings that just would somehow got here and by mistake, or somehow it was a mess up at birth, or something wasn't quite right. And used to feel quite envious of what I considered normal people, what were considered normal types of American people. That attitude about oneself, and it was very being brought up in a society where having a personality and being somebody is so important. Being an individual, a person. And that's very much the emphasis of my generation was that it was a generation for proclaiming your independence and your uniqueness and your personality. And yet, with all that, there was this underlying sense of not quite being normal or not quite right. So that even in a society that had so many advantages and so was so generous, there was also this sense of anguish and despair that somehow you were stuck, or something God had dealt you a bad hand. Why did God deal me such a bad hand? Why couldn't have dealt me a good one? But all this is related to the conditions and the importance of the values that people place on the society, on political attitudes, social attitudes, and fashions of the time, so forth. Nothing was ever related to, even God was a silly God. The God that I was brought up with in my Christian family was to me a silly God. Couldn't believe in it. After I grew to a certain age, it was what was presented to me as God seemed so stupid that I just rather not believe in anything that's foolish. And so then, even God was presented as a person. Just some kind of another person that was, you know, which was just a separate thing, which tended to always be in the state of anguish because we were sinners. So we used to say that God suffered because we sinned. So I had these images of God, you know, sitting like Rodin's thinker in utter despair over me. I thought, if it's just me, think of all the billions of other people, he must, it would be hell realm to be God. Then something in me kind of thought, well, it was stupid of him anyway to create such a thing and have to suffer from it. If you're going to create something that you're going to thoroughly enjoy, not be a state of anguish over all the time. And especially one found that growing up in the maturing process of a young boy and growing into manhood, and all these things were strange things were happening, and strange feelings arose, and these were all totally unexplainable in the context of the society and the values that I grew up in. It was all somehow the wrong suggestions were given and the wrong attitudes were instilled in the mind, so that one felt one was always quite anxious or worried and never content. Felt there was something missing, something wrong with it all, or maybe it was just me, maybe there's something basically wrong with me. Because it's easy to interpret life from that, always from, because that's who's feeling it, isn't it? It's me that feels everything. And I can feel sympathy with your suffering, but I actually feel my suffering. I have to be with it. When I came across Buddhism at the age of 21, it was a relief to the mind to be able to reflect in a way that was encouraged in that particular religion. Because somehow intuitively I felt very much in tune with that way of thinking, with Buddhist thought, because it seemed somehow to explain and answer the questions that couldn't be answered through the other. And this is very much dealing with the relationship of this life as a conditioned being, existing, existence itself, in all that implies. Existing is what is like this, isn't it? Existing is having form and having consciousness. It exists. Existence is what springs forth, what arises. So existence is what we contemplate, this sense of arising, of that which springs forth, the thoughts that arise and cease in our mind, the feelings that change in our bodies, and the moods, and the whole conditioned realm that we can contemplate and reflect on during this retreat. Whatever it is, and we're looking at it now as conditions that arise and cease. Sabbe sankharani cha. All conditions are impermanent. Including the feelings of being somebody or being whatever feelings or fears or that you have about yourself as a person. You're no longer trying to figure out why you feel that way or whether it's true or not, but you're observing it as it is, that it arises and ceases. And you're looking directly at the way it is. That's Buddha contemplating Dhamma. That's not a person who's been dealt a bad hand by God, or somebody who's normal or abnormal, or somebody who's whatever, because whatever it is, whatever the quality of the condition, we're no longer judging, we're just observing its conditionedness, that it arises and ceases. So these three characteristics are nicca, dukkha, anatta. That the conditioned realm is dukkha. Now that might sound like to people as a kind of a negation of life, but it's merely a reflection that condition, the nature of conditions is their unsatisfactoriness in themselves. There's no condition that is satisfying to us in itself. Conditions arise and cease. So it's unsatisfactory as something to identify with and grasp. Not that there's like these flowers, they're conditions, aren't they? But we can't say, we aren't looking at them as they're causing me suffering. That's not what I'm saying. By looking at them, that I'm suffering. Not that flowers are suffering, but that flowers, their nature is to change, that they're conditioned so that they arise, they cease, they bloom and then they fade. That's their nature, is to be like that. So that flowers can be appreciated for what they are rather than demands made on them to be something that they cannot be. Because the mind that is contented and at ease with life and at peace is a mind that is always aware of the relationship, the perfection of the whole, rather than trying to seek security, safety, perfection in a condition or in the conditioned realm. This is the materialist mentality of this age, has tried to very much find a paradise, trying to create a paradise. If we could just extend our lifespan, we could live longer and in perfect health, in nice places with good food and everything, all the best. And yet, what have we managed to do? We find pollution and all these things becoming increasingly a threat. That we have to pay the price of our greed and our stupidity by polluting the environment that we've been trying to make into a paradise. And the way we just dump waste and rubbish and sewage into the seas and the oceans, thinking that the oceans are like bottomless pits. The sewage goes in and it just goes down, 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 down. Because the oceans to us are bottomless, aren't they? Can't see. Once you throw it into the sea, can't see it. It's all gone. Nice. That's what we do with our minds, isn't it? We try to dump the rubbish in the ocean and hope that it just stays down there where you can't see it. Until eventually you start feeling a sense of being polluted. You don't know where it's coming from. So that we, just by throwing things into the ocean, just because they disappear and you can't see them, doesn't mean they don't have their effect on our lives. And we're discovering that with our heedlessness and stupidity in just dumping waste and filth and that into the very bloodstream of a planet, isn't it? It's the currents of the oceans and all that is so important. Circulation, circulatory system of the planet. And then it's not only the wicked industrialists that suffer, but it's all everyone else, the innocent, like this, the animals, the fish, and so forth. I mean, they get, they haven't done anything wrong, but they still have to suffer for our greed, hatred, and delusion, our stupidity. So the innocent have to suffer along with the guilty in this planetary life. And we're in on the same boat. Well, we're all in this together, in other words. It's like you can't just I will have nothing more to do with this planet. you can say such things, but just by our existence here means that we're related and interconnected to the whole of it. That means everything, the good, the bad, the guilty, the innocent, the totality of it. But the great gift of our humanity is that we're these little points that can be enlightened. And these strange karmic formations that we call human beings. And that we can also be enlightened beings, which is an enlightened being is a blessing to all beings, isn't it? An enlightened human being understands the truth of the way it is, and so our lives then can be great blessings to other beings, to all other beings. Or an ignorant human being can be a nuisance, a dangerous threat. I mean, right now it's possible to set off all the nuclear weapons or the chemical warfare, weapons and that the demonic minds of people have invented. You think of some of the incredible, the most horrible things that people invent to kill each other with. And these are supposedly from civilized countries. That we spend so much money, energy, intelligence in inventing horrendous weapons to scare each other with. Hopefully we think we won't ever have to use them, but we can scare each other with them. And yet that mentality seems to, maybe hopefully we're growing out of that. There seems to be more movement away from that kind of carrying a big stick and flexing your muscles and shaking your fist and looking mean and nasty and frightening everybody to death. Because human beings can be lights in the dark. They can be enlightened beings. Now, beings are like this, aren't they? They're separate. Being implies that there are all kinds of beings on this planet that we can actually see. All the animal, the insect, the bird, the fish. The beings that of the animal realm we can actually visually see. We suspect and intuit beings of maybe ethereal types or devas or angels or deities or whatever. The being is a sense of encapsulation in some form, either a coarse material form such as we have, or maybe an ethereal form such as a deva. But being implies something that exists in its as a separate functioning entity. So we are sentient beings. Beings are sentient, aren't they? They are born and they die. They begin and end. That's true with all beings. And as we realize with the animal kingdom, insect and fish and fowl, there's also in the cosmology of Buddhism, Hinduism, there's the devas are also born and die. The Brahma gods are born and die. Anything that has a form, that is a being, is something that is born and dies. It's a condition, in other words. Now the human being then is a being that can reflect on the way things are within the limitations that we find ourselves. We have this reflective mind. Is what we're using, what we're developing in meditation here, is the ability to reflect on existence, on the way things are. And it's not something that you can just do overnight, is it? Just one meditation retreat and you've got it. Because it is a lifetime of reflection. It's learning to observe, awaken to life and the experience of being and breathing and feeling and consciousness through the lifetime of this being here. It's lifespan. Because this is the resultant karma of birth. And when it's time for this being to die, that's not for us to say, is it? When that time comes, that's the karma. That's up to karma. We're not trying to make any deals for a long life or for a short one. Not trying to say, I want a really long life. Or to think we be nice to have a short one, get enlightened and die. I have to live through the 80s and 90s in an aging, deteriorating old body. It's pretty hard going sometimes, isn't it, Sister Upala? The 80s, the physical 80s. But yet the karma is this. It's what we can reflect on, and this is what we accept, and we're willing to take on the karma. We can determine it, and we can say this to ourselves. We can make that our intention to accept the karma of our lives, the way things are as we experience it as an individual being. In that way, we're no longer just reacting and conflicting or trying to get out of anything, but we're actually quite willing to accept the resultant karma of our birth in whatever forms and pleasant or unpleasant those qualities may be. Because this form is something that what we do with it, think with it, say with it, it affects it. That it becomes, what if we speak out of ignorance and greed, hatred, and delusion, then it has its effect on this form, and on the planet we live on. We're not totally isolated, independent from the environment we're living in. Oh, we were very much a part of the totality, of the whole, of this universal system. So sometimes we might think, what I do is my own business. I can live my life the way I want to. It's my business, my life. None of your business, not your life. That's how oftentimes we're brought up to think, isn't it? I'm an independent, totally independent person. So it's my life and I can do with it what I want. But when you contemplate Dhamma, you realize that it's not really your life and that it is everybody's business. Because how I live my life is going to affect you, isn't it? What I do and say and think is going to have its effect on you, on the planet. And if I live and act and speak and do things in unskillful, heedless, selfish, foolish ways, that's going to affect everyone else. But if I live in a way that is moral and skillful, virtuous, caring, careful, then that's for the welfare of other beings, because this form here then is being used as something for the that is a blessing, helping, a benefit to others. And so therefore we begin when we realize that, have that insight, then we really long to do what is right, what is good. At least I do, not only for my own happiness, but because I don't want to be responsible for causing more suffering to you than necessary, because you create enough suffering already for yourself, and without, you know, and I'm sure you don't need me to create more for you, do you? Do you want me to make you suffer more? I'll become really selfish and cruel. And so you increase your suffering. But I see that, you know, that would be wrong to do. That the suffering that is important to see is the suffering you create in your mind. Not the suffering that somebody causing you because they are being nasty and wicked and cruel and selfish to you, but it's actually in a community like this where people are trying to be kind and careful and considerate and respectful to each other, where you don't have you aren't trying just to survive and try to hold your own in a system that is cruel and brutal and tyrannical. But where you're actually living in a moral community that's aspiring to realize ultimate truth, and then you can be aware of the suffering you create, even under the best circumstances. And from there, that's why if you to develop Dhamma practice, you really need to have that foundation of sila, of moral commitment, and to have spiritual friends, kalyanamitas, people that encourage and help and support each other toward the holy life. Because if you are living in a society where people are brutal and cruel and unkind and are just taking advantage of you, exploiting you, your mind has to deal with survival, don't you? You're just living in a realm of instinctual survival, and you don't have time to contemplate ultimate reality. You're just trying to make it through this life on the instinctual plane of just trying to exist and survive in an unwholesome, brutal, unkind system you find yourself in. So that's one reason why the Buddha established the monastic form, monastery, monastic life, where actually you're living with people who are developing in that spiritual way, where we tend to attract to us. And that you find most of the people that come here to Amaravati are quite wholesome and good types of human beings. We seldom have problems with attracting criminals and terrorists and gangsters and drug addicts and all the kind of violent world that exists, doesn't it? It still exists in London and places like that, but we don't really see it because those kind of beings stay away from places like this. They can't bear it. They see a Buddhist monk, all they can do is yell at you, some insult you, you know, walking to Hemel Hempstead, and the lorries come by, or men in cars coming looking like they haven't any kind of intelligence whatsoever. They just shout some horrible thing at you. Because all they see is, or they just react to something strange. It's like a cat seeing a mouse. They don't understand it. They think they just react with some kind of foolish, stupid reaction. They wouldn't think, what are these monks, what are these nuns, why do they do that? Why do those women shave their heads? Why don't they grow their hair out and curl it and wear beautiful dresses? Why do those, they don't reflect, do they? They contemplate it. They just, skinhead and... Now then, but then the people that do question, why? What did they? What are they? Why do they? What do they believe in? Why do they live that way? What do they do? Wonder what they're doing. What is meditation? Then you're beginning to question and ask. That means your mind is searching for something, isn't it? It's beginning to reflect. Why is it like this? Why do they do that? Because it's obviously not. You know, the whole appearance, the presence of a samana is quite striking, isn't it? It leaves a firm impression on the mind. This is when we look at the stars at night, we wonder, what is it all about? So that's a kind of reflecting attitude, isn't it? What is up there in that vast, unknown, mysterious universe that we can only see little points of light with our eyes? What is this strange experience of being incarcerated in a form like this for a lifetime? What does it all mean? These are the questions that haunt humanity and always have. What is the purpose of it? What is its meaning? Before, a few kind of exceptional human beings would ask those questions. Most people would be willing to just be told. You go to church and the preacher tells you all about it and you believe it. The whole nicely written down and explained in scriptures and traditions, and therefore you don't have to think about it or wonder about it because you've got the answers in a book. The priest can tell you. So you never develop a reflective mind or that kind of penetrating, looking deep into this experience of being alive, because so many human beings are just willing to accept the answers that they see that they get from others or from books, what they're told. That's nice to believe what somebody tells you, who you think it knows. But this thing, what we're doing here, is actually we're not in the Buddhist teaching. It's not a doctrine of telling you what everything is or what you should be, but in investigating, looking into the nature of things. The Buddha seeing the Dhamma is that. Take that as a kind of symbol, the Buddha contemplating the Dhamma. The awakened human mind open and reflecting on the way things are within this realm of this human realm that we have to live in for a lifetime. This evening is the all-night sitting, but because of the amount of illness that this community's had since this retreat began, whether you, those of you who still don't feel very strong, or still dodgy, better not attempt to sit up all night. Use your good sense in regards to these matters. You know how you're feeling, so I leave it up to you to decide what you think would be the wise thing to do. So, anyway, whatever you decide, it doesn't mean that you just because you go back to your room doesn't mean that you don't reflect on the way things are, does it? So that it's not, don't develop the vipassanini mind where you only meditate on a cushion. But you actually, they say, when you graduate out of the school of vipassaninis, then you're one who contemplates life as it actually is happening to you, wherever you happen to be, sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. In the shrine room, or in your private room, or in the kitchen, or walking outside, or standing. And you had a heart attack out in the courtyard, then you contemplate that, lying down. Don't let anything throw you off the track.